American renewal is our topic on this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. Syndicated columnist Neil Patel wrote these words recently. It's hard not to worry about America's future these days. Warning signs are everywhere. Trust in institutions is at an all-time low. Inflation is out of control. The nation's long-term finances are in shambles. People are at each other's throats. Drug overdoses are booming. Suicide is booming. Growing elements on both the left and the right are convinced the political system is broken beyond despair. Disturbing numbers of Americans are willing to resort to political violence. The country is in crisis. Now, Neil Patel, who wrote those words, is the co-founder of the Daily Caller, which I believe he co-founded with Tucker Carlson, and he joins us right now on Vocal Point. And Neil, it's great to talk with you and have you on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Awesome to be here. Thank you.
Sure. You're a great writer. You can tell just by these opening sentences from this column I read from you.
And well, nice of you to say that. I employ a lot of writers, so this is a secondary pastime for me, but I do like doing it. Thank you.
Sure. And the particular column, I'll link to it, but it's titled this, Avoiding the Approaching American Catastrophe. And before we get into the whole issue of American renewal and turning things around and what you write about, we all seem to have this sense, even people on the left will recognize and acknowledge, yeah, the country's not headed in the right direction. But before we get into the meat of the content, just tell us a little bit about your own background and especially the Daily Caller, because this is a major website people should subscribe to and, you know, get information from.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about it. You know, we view ourselves still as a startup, but the Daily Caller, I started with Tucker Carlson about 12 years ago, actually. And we looked out at the media 12 years ago, and the internet was obviously taking over from the print newspapers, and we didn't think there was enough reporting that was done that wasn't liberal. Obviously, the print newspaper world has sort of had a liberal bias for many years. Most of us know that, but the internet provided this new opportunity to hire reporters and put out real news with much less cost than you used to have to do in the newspaper world. So Tucker Carlson and I got together to start the Daily Caller to do that. And our model is to sort of replicate what newspapers do in the sense of real factual reporting on the news of the day, and to put out, you know, we're currently putting out a couple hundred pieces of original news a day. And over those 12 years, we've grown to about 20 million readers a month. So it's got some scale. We employ 100 people. And we're just trying to be the balance, because the news in America, as you know, is not balanced. And it's gone from biased to, I would say, corrupt in the coverage. And that is really bad for a democracy. And we're just trying to do our part to anything we can to tilt the scales back closer, at least, to even.
Well, good for you. Now, I'm sure you deal with this problem all the time, but big tech censorship, canceling, shadow banning, whatever, taking, you know, all kinds of different ploys, but essentially to deplatform conservative voices, such as yours.
Yes, you know, we work hard to work with big tech because I want to reach as many people as I can. And to reach people, you've got to work through all the intermediaries these days, whether that's Twitter or Facebook or any one number of these big platforms, Google certainly, which controls the vast majority of the advertising. So we all need to work with these. There are many of them are monopolies, and it is a challenge, especially for more conservative leaning news outlets. But we have to do it. That's our view, at least, because we've got to reach as many people as possible. That's our mission.
Well, how do you do it, though, in ways in which you're not really watering down your message?
We just try to tell the truth. And if someone harasses us for telling the truth, we try to push back. We do try to build as many personal relations with reasonable people as we can. Any company in America has a range of people, some in many, the range is from sort of liberal to extremely liberal. But, you know, you find the most reasonable person you can to listen to your arguments at any venue. That's the way we've always done it.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is a good good thing that you guys are doing to, you know, work towards American renewal. Do you think that in some ways, I mean, I don't want to be pessimistic, but in some ways we've gone so far down this cultural Marxist route, it seems, as a country. At least, you know, it's in the control, the major institutions are in the control of such that, you know, is there a certain point of no return? And I'm sure we haven't reached that, but I trust we haven't. Your thoughts, please.
You know, Jerry, I worry about it daily. I think the country is sliding. I think we all feel it. I think that's driving a lot of what's going on in American politics today. I think a lot of Americans feel that, and maybe most Americans feel that. And what worries me is we're not close to addressing these issues. We're not close to sort of hitting bottom, and there's no feeling that we're on the way back yet. And we're falling so far that you wonder, are we ever going to have that feeling? Are we ever going to try to, you know, come back? And I'm really more focused right now than on the bigger picture than any single policy issue. I mean, I can give you a whole list of policy issues I think are really daunting, including the debt and you know, the current crime and open borders and so many. But until we address the polarization in the country, until people are at least able to talk to each other and debate, and secondly, until the American people are able to regain trust in their leaders and in their institutions, I don't think there's any hope to address the other policy issues. And we're not in a place where either of those two things, the polarization and the trust, are anywhere near being fixed. And that's what worries me the most.
Okay, you and I are having this discussion. It's going to be posted later, but we're having this discussion on October 10th. Which, by the way, it happens to be Columbus Day, but I saw in my personal pocket calendar or whatever, which is a print edition thing, and it said Indigenous Peoples Day. It didn't even say Columbus Day or Indigenous Peoples Day. It's just Indigenous Peoples Day. There's kind of been a war, not kind of, there has been a war, and there continues to be a war on American history. And as you write in your article, America's not perfect. It never has been, but measured by historic standards or comparative world standards, America is an amazing place. Saving it is a worthy cause. How about some comments about America, the war on history, you know, and you know, what is America?
So, you know, this obviously all this war on America and rewriting American history started in our higher level academic institutions many years ago. You know, I went to college in the 80s. This stuff was going on then, and I think a lot of us were a little too complacent, thinking these are just crazy college professors. They're never going to influence much beyond them, but they've influenced, you know, decades of children now. And if you see a lot of the leadership coming up, especially in certain parts of the country, you know, they're completely influenced by this sort of woke academic mindset, which is not only wrong, but kind of mindless. I mean, the study of American history, you know, obviously America has had problems, but if you just step back, has America been a force for good or a force for bad in the world? And I mean, it's I don't know how you could argue anything besides the former, you know, and they're not teaching kids that. And these people are now out of the academic world. They're running companies and they're trying to rewrite history in many ways. And it's tragic. And the only hope is that there are enough normal Americans out there who are freaked out by this stuff. And I think there is some hope for that. And I think also the other reason for optimism, and because I'm searching for those these days, you know, a lot of the newer immigrants, a lot of Hispanic, you see the way the Hispanic vote is moving. A lot of the Hispanics are more traditional people, they're family people, and they're coming in and they're repulsed by some of this stuff. So maybe that's where there's some hope. And oddly enough, the Democrats, I think many thought that that would result. You know, they wrote books about how they'd have been an enduring majority with the changes in American population. But maybe the opposite effect will come true. And it seems there's some signs of that. So, you know, I'm rewriting American history is shocking, and it's happening every day.
When you were mentioning that thing about the academic lounges, you know, of the, you know, universities and so forth, and the crazy liberal ideas that are now mainstream, it seems, I couldn't help but think of that line from Bill Buckley. It was something along this line where he said, I would rather be governed by the first 300 names or so that you find, you know, arbitrarily in the Boston phone book than to be governed by 300 professors from Harvard University. I think it's really actually an excellent point he's making. But I also want to say there is the God factor too. There is a sense in which, because of spiritual revivals and so forth, the Great Awakening and so forth, before we even the Founding Fathers even did their work with the Declaration and the Constitution, there was a spiritual side to things, and I think forgetting that is part of the reason we're in such a mess.
Yeah, for sure. And there's, you know, the hard left has, it's not just people forgetting, it's an effort by the hard left to eradicate that from the history. So, you know, the religious components to a lot of the American history are making an effort, coordinated effort, to remove those, and they're succeeding in a lot of ways because they have a lot of power. And again, that's just another part of rewriting history. And there's something grotesque about rewriting history, because if we don't have a common sense of what happened before, it's very hard to analyze things and to determine what we should do going forward.
You know, I would just make a little plug here for a book called Debunking Howard Zinn by Dr. Mary Graber, where she shows that Howard Zinn, the popular historian, he's now dead, but he wrote this classic book now. It was published in 1980, A People's History of the United States, but it's chock full of errors and even misrepresentations about our history, and she shows that. But let's use an example from your own column where you say, look at the example of Sotomayor towards Clarence Thomas and Hillary Clinton towards Clarence Thomas. Can you elaborate on that, if you recall exactly? It shows you the idea of, well, can we agree to disagree, or do we have to basically engage in the politics of personal destruction?
Yeah. I use those examples because I found them so striking, and I think they get to the core of what's going on in the country and the two options we face. You know, people of goodwill can have different attitudes, and we should be able to debate. And there's a long history, obviously, in America of doing that. And the court actually is an amazing microcosm for that. I always love the fact that Justice Scalia's best friend on the court was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And that says something good about their world, because nobody would question either one on their bona fides to their respective point of view. No conservative would question Scalia. He was a principled conservative, and we all loved him as an amazing justice. Same thing with Ginsburg on the left, yet they somehow found ways to talk and to actually befriend each other. And there's something truly American about that I love. And I was really, I found it refreshing that when I read Sotomayor's comments, obviously a newer justice, saying similar things about Clarence Thomas. Now, I know Clarence Thomas. You may know him too. A lot of people in the conservative world do. And anyone who's ever met him knows he's about the nicest guy and just the warmest guy and has this most amazing laugh. And it's just hard not to like the guy. And Sotomayor, obviously a big-time liberal, she feels the same way. And she defends him in public even at a time when that's probably not good for her, you know, amongst her lefty friends. So I found that refreshing, as opposed to Hillary Clinton, whose comments about Thomas, I mean, if they were ever made by a conservative about a liberal African-American, would be shocking. And, you know, she calls him basically an angry black man. And if you've met Clarence Thomas or anyone who knows him, nobody thinks of him that way. And that's really beyond the pale, and it's dehumanizing to him. And she clearly doesn't know him, but she can't even take the effort to treat him like a real person. And that's the difference. That's the key to me for America going forward. Can we get back to that time when we can have disagreements, but we can treat each other with civility and talk through things? Or are we at the Hillary Clinton point, which is basically political warfare?
Wow. Well, that's a great point to end on. I will refer people to creators.com for your particular columns, Neil Patel, and then dailycaller.com. Is that right, for your website?
That's right. That's our site, yes.
Neil, thanks so much for being with us. All the best.
Awesome joining you. Thanks.